Doris Kearns Goodwin, the best-selling Pulitzer Prize-winning author of No Ordinary Time and Team of Rivals, brings her blend of scholarship, intellectual rigor, and riveting storytelling to the turbulent and fateful relationship between two presidents, the rise of muckraking journalism, and the far-reaching ferment of the progressive era. Her best-selling book, The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism, is out this week in paperback. The Bully Pulpit raises questions about whether we're living in a new gilded age, whether the relationship between business and government has really changed, and whether it's possible for a president to have control of the bully pulpit anymore now that the media landscape has so changed. It is always a pleasure, a delight, to have Doris Kearns Goodwin on the program, and we welcome her this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you again, Joe. Absolutely.
I love speaking with you. The last time I saw you, we were in Saratoga doing a wonderful event for the Northshire Bookstore.
I remember it well.
On stage, and we got a lot more time to talk than we do this morning. But I'm curious as to, since that time, because at that time the book had just come out in hardcover and was only a few days old, what has the reaction been to not only the book, but to these two presidents and to this idea of the bully pulpit?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that became clearer even to me as I talked about the book and to people who read it is that there are really difficulties today for the bully pulpit in a way that there weren't back at the time when Teddy first defined the phrase, because he was able to command the attention of the airwaves, the such colorful language that the press had him as headlines wherever he spoke. On those train trips, he would be close to the people in whistle-stop tours, talking to them in the language that they could understand, so that it was simple, folksy. And nowadays, it just seems like when a president, and we've seen it in these recent months too, speaks to the public, there's no longer the three television networks to cover him. It's much more divided up. That challenge of speaking simply and making clear what it is that you're talking about will be a huge challenge for the president as he talks about ISIS. So that challenge is still there. But there's a distractedness on the part of the public that was much more following political events back then that makes it harder, I think, to break through, not just because of the media, you know, and the blogs and the Facebook and the Internet, but because our lives are so complex right now that politics hasn't got the same centrality, I think, that it did for the people living at that time when they were able to address the problems that the Gilded Age put forth.
Has the term itself gone through a transition of the bully pulpit of becoming, even with that word bully in it, that there is a more negative connotation now?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, obviously it's true. Bully, when Teddy Roosevelt used it, simply meant delighted, great. You know, it had nothing
right
to do with bullying people and pushing them in a certain way. And so that changes. When time goes on, a word takes on a different connotation. And even pulpit was an odd word at the time. But what he meant was that a president could have a moral impact on the country by educating them to the problems of the country. So it may well be that the term itself may need some change as time goes by. I hadn't thought about that until you just asked it. But the idea behind it remains true, which is that the president still remains the leader who presumably has the largest opportunity to mobilize public opinion and sentiment. But today, given the media, a lot of other voices are heard much more than they would have been before, loud voices, and they have access to the media in ways that they wouldn't have back in his time, so the competition is much greater.
I love talking to you about the process, and I remember in our conversation in Saratoga, you were talking about how this book evolved and the evolution of this book, and telling the story of Teddy Roosevelt and the progressive era. How did William Howard Taft come into that story and stay around for a while?
Yeah, well, he came in at the beginning because I just read widely at the start to just get a feeling for the characters, and I knew I needed something other than a biography on Teddy because so much had been written that was so good on him so recently. And when I got a hold of these 400 letters that Taft and Teddy had written to each other from the time they were young, when they met in Washington as young people having gone to Solicitor General's role and the Civil Service role, And the letters were so intimate, you know, talking, I beloved, I miss you, I wish we could be together. I began to see that this friendship was much deeper than I certainly had known from my reading of history. And then as I followed the relationship of Taft through, he became really a central figure for me in my imagination. I mean, it's so much more decent than I had known. We so superficially gauged him as a fat president who got stuck in the tub and who lost the election in 1912. And he had so many qualities that I think really deserved to be honored. You know, he was fair and just and amiable, good-tempered. He may not have had the public leadership qualities, in fact, he didn't, that Teddy Roosevelt had, and that's partly why his presidency drifted. But he also had such a deep connection to his wife, Nellie, that when she got a stroke, he took care of her, and his presidency drifted in part because of that, something that Teddy may not have done because Teddy was so much more centered on work and going forward. So the idea of the contrast between these two really began to intrigue me. And I love writing human stories about the relationships between people. That's why it was always Franklin and Eleanor, Lincoln and his cabinet guys, because somehow that hopefully allows the reader to follow people, and then they'll care about the larger historical canvas if they care about the people.
Maybe I'm reading too much into this, but I, in reading the book, I got the sense that the characteristics and the ingredients, if you will, that brought these two men together were very much the reasons that drifted them apart eventually.
No question. No, I think they had differences right from the start, and maybe those opposites attracted. Teddy would say of Taft that he has such a lovable personality that people like him on first sight, whereas it takes longer for somebody to really grasp a hold of his more complicated personality. Taft would say of Teddy, he's such a fighter. I wish I could fight like he does. And that, of course, became a problem later on when he wasn't fighting, according to Teddy, hard enough against the conservatives when he was president. So I think it's true that part of it was personalities that were opposites attracting when they were working together on a common cause. But then when they were split apart, those opposites became even more extreme and led to this rupture in the friendship that really saddened both men, I think, and had a huge impact. When they ran against each other, it meant that that was the end of Teddy Roosevelt's career in politics, really, because he splits off from the Republican Party. The Bull Moose Party gathers more votes than Taft, but still it's Republicans splitting two votes, and the Democrat wins, and the progressive movement loses its champion and its force. And Taft, of course, loses, but ends up in the end finding what he always wanted, the Supreme Court Chief Justiceship. Mm. And they finally do reconcile in the end. I kept following them for year after year after year, hoping that they'd get together, and was so happy that they finally did.
I love reading the book. I love devouring the book, but it became a page turner for me when you start talking about this golden age of journalism, which is part of the subtitle, because that whole idea of McClure's that you write about in such detail, and what journalism was and sadly what it has become, but it is fascinating to see that golden age and what could be accomplished. Talk a little bit about what brought you to McClure's specifically, and the incredible writing that was taking place at that time.
I'd always heard about Ida Tarbell and Lincoln Steffens, but I hadn't really realized that they had been, along with Ray Baker and William Allen White, at this one magazine at the turn of the 20th century that was the most important progressive magazine. And as I started to study Teddy Roosevelt's public leadership, I realized how much of it depended on his close relationship to these members of the press, who would feed him the stories that he could then talk to the public about, of what corruption was going on in the city, what should happen to Standard Oil to break it up. And I just became fascinated with them as a family in itself. In fact, you know, the rights to the bully pulpit have been taken up by Steven Spielberg, and there's some possibility that there could be two different films in it. One would be the Teddy Taft friendship breakup, the 1912 election, their reconciliation. And the other would be Ida Tarbell and this group at McClure's, because they really did form a family, and they felt a sense that they had a mission to perform by spending years doing research to produce these factually based indictments of Standard Oil or the railroads or the meatpacking plants or fake medicine flooding the market. And then they saw regulation happen. They achieved what they hoped. In fact, they said the pen was mightier than the sword in their generation. So it does recall a time when you wish journalists today could feel that sense of fulfillment to know they had made such a difference. Even later in their lives, they looked back on these years as the happiest and most fulfilling of their lives.
Her career is incredible, and I know in the past year you have been credited, rightfully so, for bringing her back to our conscious and our understanding of what she did and as a pioneer. I'm curious as to why you think that she was sort of shuffled away there for a while, especially when she was writing about Lincoln in this 20-part series of how important her work was.
No question. I mean, she was at that time considered the most important female historian, not just journalist, because she wrote these books on Lincoln. She interviewed people who had known Lincoln when he was young. She wrote a big series on Napoleon before she got into the investigative work. And then once she did Standard Oil, they talked about her as the Joan of Arc of American journalism. She never married, so this was her career, this was her mission. And she also was the mother hen of this group. She was so kindly toward the others. They had all these battles, and she would keep them going. And she definitely deserves to be the figure that is remembered. And the fact that she was a woman, I mean, they had a play on Broadway where it was the Standard Oil guy, J.D. Rockefeller, and her, pursuing her and taking her on a long trip to get rid of her and trying to have her on a honeymoon. I mean, there were jokes, there were cartoons, and it all somehow made her this larger-than-life figure. And I don't know what happens in schools of journalism now, but you would hope that in these schools it's important to bring these figures back to remind modern journalists this is what's possible. I mean, yes, it's harder because they got 2 years of research before they had to write anything, and they had 30,000-word pieces published that people devoured because they had time to read then. They weren't as distracted as we were now. But still, lots of people go into journalism with that same hope of making a difference, of having a mission. And to read about these people who really did do it, I think should give comfort, solace, and even direction for what might happen today.
And there was also access.
I mean, extraordinary access to Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, that was the unusual partnership. He had enough self-confidence that he was willing to let them criticize him, and he would argue with them. They could have really striking arguments at times because they would often be more, at that time, you might say, more liberal than he, less pragmatic, and he would argue, you don't understand what can be possible, and then they would criticize him in print, and he would criticize them in print, but the friendships remained. And then he was able, on the basis of their work, to give human stories. Instead of just writing about Standard Oil as an abstract monopoly,
right,
Ida Tarbell told it in such a way that you saw the suffering that people had gone through from the small businesses that got eaten up by Standard Oil. The railroad, you saw how unfairly they were making their monopolies. You saw the corruption in the cities through Stephens, through human stories. And I think storytelling is what people always respond to, and that's what McClure said to his people. The story is the thing. That is the thing. And he was so right.
It does seem if Spielberg wanted to make a third film, it could be about Edith Roosevelt and Nellie Taft.
No, there's truth to that, too. I mean, that relationship between those two, so different, even more different than Teddy and Taft in some ways, because Edith was such a private woman, had loved Teddy from the time she was young. Had no interest in being a public person, said that a woman's name should appear in press only twice, when she's married and when she's buried. Lost him for a while when he fell in love with another woman in college, but then that woman, Alice, died in childbirth, and he came back to Edith, and she provided a sanctuary for him, a home away from the tumult of politics, whereas Nellie Taft, from the time she was young, had loved politics and really wanted to be a figure in her own right, loved going to the working class bars, wanted to teach, really loved the idea of going to college, but her parents sent her brothers, not her. So she thought she wouldn't marry, so she'd have a chance to be something, and until she met Will Taft, who promised her a partnership. And then she was the one who really was his political advisor, helped him on his speeches, probably moved him toward politics in a way that he wouldn't have gone without her. And the happiest day of her life was when he became president And she then said, I'm going to be a public figure, just the opposite of Edith. And she created a public park in Washington, worked on working class women's issues, and really was set to become like an Eleanor Roosevelt until she had this devastating stroke months later and was never able to speak connectedly again. And that loss for him was really, I think, the blow that shifted his presidency. It's hard to imagine how different it might have been had that not happened.
I have such admiration for you as a writer because you are able to get so much into a book without giving a subject short shrift. I'm curious as to how you balance, and ultimately through an editing process, I'm sure, that you are able to juggle that all in such a delicate way.
Well, thank you for that. I mean, I think the hardest thing is to figure out how to structure the stories, because you've got, as you pointed out, a whole bunch of different stories you're telling, and where do you start telling one person's story? At what point do you bring it in? And then how far do you go with it before you have to go back to the main story? And that's the thing that I'd like to think is what I can do. I mean, it takes a long time to do that, because you could go on too much with one person and then you've lost track of the main story you're telling. And I've had to redo things over and over again. I remember even with Team of Rivals, I started out telling each one of those four stories all the way up to 1860, and then I was repeating myself over and over again. So I had to intertwine them in a different way. I mean, the price you pay is that these books get long. You know, in fact, the one benefit greatly of the paperback is that it is less heavy than the hardback. So that I got a note from a woman who was reading the hardback of The Bully Pulpit, and she said that it was very nice. She said she was loving it, but she happened to fall asleep while she was reading it, and it broke her nose.
Oh!
So now I can promise, hopefully, with the paperback, it's still fat, but it's less fat and it's less heavy. So that's the grand thing about having this new paperback come out.
But I mean, the other thing, and I remember saying this to my wife after I finished this book, was after 750 pages, you wish there were another 750 pages more.
Well,
you know,
you couldn't tell me anything more that I would, Matt, love to hear. Thank you.
I mean, and as you said, it's incredible because you probably could write another compelling 750 pages on the subject.
Oh, I look back now and I think, you know, sometimes, should I have just done a book on Teddy and the Muckrakers, and then it would have been thinner? Or I could have just done a book on Teddy and Taft, you know, and then it would have been thinner. But the way it all interweaved with each other was critical to both Teddy's relationship with Taft and with the Muckrakers. So it felt like I needed to do this. And yes, I could have gone on so much longer. But at a certain point, you know, the publishers are saying, okay, 7 years have gone by, it's time. And that luckily the deadline makes it come to an end.
As a presidential historian, and just in our final moments, I was speaking with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright last week, and she said, look, the country's in a mess. Do you look at it right now of what this president is facing and say, yes, the country is, we in the world position globally, it's a mess?
It does seem like it feels more unclear than it's been before. I mean, there's so many challenges, a multiplicity of challenges that the president has to face, and there are different pieces in different parts of the world. You know, the Cold War was probably more intense, the idea that there could be a nuclear war at any moment, which we lived it, you know, in those days when you're hiding under your desk. But at least there was containment as a policy that we knew was what we were striving toward. Obviously, World War II and that run-up to World War II was a terrifying time as Hitler was conquering Western Europe, one state, one nation after another. But there was a sense here that we knew, at least Roosevelt, that he had to mobilize the country because these were the Allies and these were the people that had to be defeated, the Nazis and the fascists. So it's now different kinds of enemies in different parts of the world, and they're not states, and they pop up in various places. So, yeah, I think it's really complicated. I'm sure, you know, if you were Lincoln living with the breakup of America as you become president, that's going to seem even more difficult, and maybe it was. And history does give you solace, and knowing we've gotten through terrible times before, we can do it again. But right now there's a sense, I think, on the part of the public, which is scary, of not being understanding enough of what's going on, which is why these speeches, I think, are going to be so important.
Yes, the president will be speaking tonight, which, of course, we'll be covering here on NPR at 9 o'clock. Doris Kearns Goodwin's latest is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. The book is out in paperback from Simon & Schuster. Doris, it's always a great pleasure. I have such admiration and affection for you, and I thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Well, it's very mutual, Joe. Thank you, thank you. I hope I see you soon again.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.